tonight on Arena. We're talking about the latest Sunday Miscellany anthology, a new T.G. Carr documentary about Gene Kelly, and Jess Fahey on Nativity Art. You can text us on 51551. Of course, our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32. Email arena@rte.ie. And we're on Instagram as well at @RTE_arena. And that might be handy for a little bit later on when we're talking about nativity art. Sunday Miscellany is a kind of time capsule. The way we talk, the things we love, the memories we keep polishing and passing down. Over the years, contributors have written about everything from bogs to Beethoven, from first loves to lost dogs, from GAA matches to Greek myths, sometimes all in the same essay. That's part of writer Paul Howard's speech when he was launching the latest Sunday Miscellany anthology recently. Sunday Miscellany, A Selection, 2023-25, is published by New Island Books and features about 150 pieces heard on the programme over the last couple of years. It was nominated for an Post Irish Book Award and is currently number 3 in the paperback non-fiction bestseller list in Ireland. Sarah Binchy, who produces the programme, edited the book. She joins me now along with two of its contributors, Conor Linehan and Niall McArdle, and you're all very welcome. Welcome to Arena tonight. Sarah, Sunday Miscellany is different to any other programme on Irish radio. Let's take an imaginary person who has never heard Sunday Miscellany before. Describe it to them.
I would describe it as reflection stories, memoir pieces, non-fiction from all sorts of writers, nationally renowned, internationally renowned, but also people who are new to the world of radio or new to the world of literature, but have a story to tell. It's interspersed with complimentary music, and we do feature the occasional poem as well. So it's about 50 minutes, of just voices and music. Sometimes, depending on, because it does happen, like if we're doing a live show, we might have a writer who amazingly hasn't heard of this programme yet, or from another country or something. So when I'm explaining it, I might talk about the Moth Radio Hour, or I might talk about This American Life, or Words and Music and BBC Radio 3, but none of them are exactly the same. And as Paul said at the lunch, it's kind of, he said, it's this Irish institution. It's like going to mass or giving out about the weather, but it's quite hard to exactly encapsulate it. But it's a moment, it's a companionable programme for a lot of people because it's been on air for coming up to 6 decades.
I don't think it's like either of those things at all. the structure of it is quite wonderfully unique as well, in that there is no introduction, there is no presenter. Yeah. It sort of just drifts into your Sunday morning.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's meeting people at the start of their day when they're a little sleepy. And I think that as someone who used to produce a late night programme as well, I like that. I like the idea that you're kind of maybe invading people's dreams a little. And it's got to be a little bit quiet as well for that reason. Or not, the signature tune might wake you up, Galliar Battaglia. But in terms of the tone that the writers take, it's gentle, it's a voice in your ear. I think of it, it might sound kind of hokey, but I really genuinely do think of it as the listener is your friend, or the voices on the radio are your friend. That is the tone you're looking for. Not a fake intimacy, but something authentic and sincere. That would be one way I would describe it.
In terms of those new voices, because if you listen to Sunday Miscellany, you will hear names or voices that you might be familiar with. How important, though, are those new writers, potentially those people who never had an item on radio before?
Well, I'd always be looking out for that. I'd be looking out to widen the pool, the bandwidth, but always keep faith with the voices that people have heard going back decades. You know, it's actually quite a big programme to fill. We sometimes have 7 pieces on per week, 52 weeks a year. So there is genuinely room for a huge number of voices. I feel every time you bring someone new in, it's just sort of saying to the listener, look, you know, this isn't a closed shop, you know. And it's a programme very much in dialogue with its listeners. I do think that, like, if you think about selective literary magazines, often an editor of a small literary magazine might lament they have more submissions than they have readers. That ain't the case with us because, you know, there's 300,000 plus listeners. They know what we're about. So we are interested in what is on their minds. And the vast majority we commission, of course, and sometimes it's a soft commission. I might, you know, like Connor here, we that was just a conversation. Connor was doing music on the programme. And at some point, I think we said, well, maybe you'd write something, a story he had similarly with Niall and other people. But generally, it's I'm interested in going through that postbag and seeing what's on people's minds. It's a very pleasurable experience. It's also painful because you can only feature a very small number. But nearly every story has something in it. And my colleague, Elaine Conlon, who's an absolutely brilliant broadcast coordinator on the programme and who organises and keeps tabs on all the stories, we're always looking out for something that we feel will really suit this programme.
I have two of those contributors here and two of those who are featured in the anthology as well. Writer Niall McArdle, composer Conor Linehan. You're both very welcome to the programme. Niall, you're an established writer, so how different is your approach to writing for audio than, let's say, if you were writing an essay or a short story?
Oh, well, it's very different because I think that you have to be aware that you're obviously writing for the ear, and it has to, but it has to do two things at once. It has to work on the page, but it also really has to work for the listener. And as Sarah said, because the listeners on Sunday morning are maybe just waking up, you have to be aware of the rhythm of what you're writing and also be aware that the tone in which the piece is going to be read, regardless of the subject matter, you know, because, you know, radio is quite intimate in a way that television isn't, and very different from, of course, from the page. So I know for me that when I'm writing what I know is going to be a radio essay, I'm very attuned to the sound of it and to the rhythm of it and to how I think the listener, who probably is still waking up, is going to receive it.
Connor, your experience was different to Niall's in that you aren't a writer. So initially, apart from Sarah's gentle prodding, what gave you the idea that maybe writing an item for Sunday Miscellany might be for you?
Well, my wife wrote a piece around 6 months earlier and I just couldn't be outdone.
Usual piece about the botanic gardens.
Valerie Waters wrote a beautiful piece about when she was training to be a horticulturalist in the botanic gardens, and a kind of very memorable experience that happened to her while she was there. And it was a really absolutely gorgeous piece. And I thought, well, I'll have a crack too. But my piece is nowhere near as beautiful or profound as that in the slightest.
That is the right answer. Tell me about Cocktail Piano Teen Sensation.
Yeah, it's basically when I was a young fellow, 15, I started playing in restaurants all around Dublin. And I continued this sort of side hustle just as a way of making money when I was in school and holidays and then as a student for the next 8 or 9 years. And it was a very, it was a very enjoyable way of making money, actually.
You're going to read a little something from us.
I'll read the first paragraph or so just to give you an idea. In the summer of 1987, aged 15, I sat myself down at the piano in Dublin's Trocadero restaurant and struck up a jaunty, if callow, rendition of Cole Porter's Let's Fall in Love. So began my career as Ireland's youngest barfly pianist, and 9 years of interrupting people's dinners. Equipped, as I then was, with only 10 tunes, my stint at the Troc was understandably short-lived. After all, no matter how lovely Let's Fall in Love might be, the prospect of birds, bees, and even educated fleas doing it at half-hour intervals proved too much for all but the most indulgent, drunk, or deaf diners. I was gently let go after a month or so and resolved to expand my skimpy set list. The following summer, now a hardened 16-year-old pro, with repertoire significantly enhanced, my career as a cocktail piano teen sensation really took off.
Let's have a listen to you playing Cole Porter's Let's Fall in Love.
Thank you.
And that is Cole Porter's Let's Fall in Love, played by Conor Linehan, who's here tonight. Sarah, how important is music to the programme?
I suppose it is a critical part of the listening experience. In an hour or close to an hour, what can really work nicely is when you've got quite a variety of sounds. But that doesn't always happen week to week. But when it does, it works very well. I suppose I like the piece of music that follows the script to match it in mood or feeling. Maybe more than it's something literal, you know, but I wouldn't be too clever with it. But, you know, if the piece is playful, the music that follows should be playful. It can't be solemn. Even if the piece is very sad, the music that follows can't be a complete lament, but it's got to have a degree of profundity, you know. Writers often know a great piece of music. I'm interested in all the recommendations. Ultimately, I decide because I have to think about how the programme feels as a whole. But we are, of course, blessed in RTE. We have all the wonderful lyric colleagues beside us. We have John Kelly, who is like a human Spotify. I'm not sure he would appreciate that description. But
It's okay. He's doing something else right now.
That's all right, of course.
It's fine.
But no, it's a great pleasure picking the music. I mean, I don't know what the collective noun is for a group of Radio 1 producers, but I've been at gatherings where the debate raged about whether you should have music with words. Can you have songs? Should it all be instrumental? My view is, no, I like songs, but I sometimes have to pull back from having too many songs because I understand that the listener sometimes wants to digest what they've heard and not be hit with something else. But sometimes, like, say, an opera piece in another language, it's the human voice, but it's not the words, unless you happen to be fluent in Italian or whatever. Those words aren't necessarily fighting with it. So it's case by case. Sometimes it can be great fun, you know. Yes.
And in terms of what are you looking for when people submit items? Because obviously, as you said, you commission some, there are established writers, but there are people who will just send a piece to you potentially.
Yeah, and most of the regular contributors, I should say, just send their pieces in on spec. It isn't really like a twin track thing. Obviously, it helps when you've been on once and everybody was happy. It went well. Then we know, and I can hear your voice in my head the next time I'm reading it because the sound of your voice is a huge part of it. But in terms of what I'm looking for, I cannot define it. Because if I could, you know, it would be so easy. But you're looking for a sort of tickle, a little feeling when you read the piece. Oh, this is nice. I like, you know, at a very basic level, read the guidelines and follow them. You know, don't send a big long yoke in and say, oh, well, I'm not going to waste any more time unless you're interested. No, I can't get into those conversations. Just the really, the pieces where the writer has done all the work, thought about it, and it's something that's coming out of them. They're revealing something of themselves in the piece, but they've constructed it well. Like you talk about Niall's piece, which you might be reading for you now, and Connor's piece. Beautiful construction and flow. And flow is actually one of the most important things in a little 5-minute, 6-minute essay. And I think absence of flow sinks a huge number of pieces because it can't just be fact followed by observation. It's just your voice. You're getting the national airwaves for 5-6 minutes. You're holding the listener's hand. You've got to bring them with them. You don't want to lose them. You don't want to bore them, but confuse them. So you have to be absolutely in control. So a writer who is in control of their material knows what they're doing. That's certainly something that we are looking out for.
Niall, you're obviously one of those people. You have a piece in the anthology. Talk to us a little bit about that.
So I was living in Bolivia in very early 2020. And so January, of course, is the height of summer. And in Bolivia, there are stray dogs everywhere. And they're blithely ignored, except for the one which decided to bite me. Which is exactly what happened. And that was that's what the piece is about.
Can you read us a little something?
I will, of course. It was a beautiful day in La Paz in January, the height of Bolivian summer. I was heading for the Valley de las Animas, the Valley of the Souls, a geological curiosity formed from volcanic rock, whose name suggested magic and incantations and all sorts of things that the boy in me still relished from growing up on tales of adventure. Where the bus stopped, however, was hardly what you'd call mysterious. Instead, I found myself amidst rubble-strewn streets, half-built or falling down houses clinging to the hillside. I trudged up and down steep cobbled paths in search of the entrance to the canyon. That was when the dog bit me. Stray dogs are everywhere in Bolivia. You can't avoid them. They bask in the noontime sun. They sleep in the doorways to shops, so you often have to step over them to enter. They roam in packs, chasing cars and minibuses, and the air is filled with the sound of barking and honking car horns. I remember one pooch in the jungle that refused to budge from the middle of the road, forcing our minibus to swerve out of its way.
You said in an essay a couple of years ago, Niall, that I often listen to it in bed, my mind only just surfacing from the muddied depths of a confusing dream, cozy under the duvet and loath to draw the curtains on the morning outside. It is part of the unique nature of the programme, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, as I say, like it is this, there is this something very intimate and unique about Miscellany. And as you said, and as Sarah said, the fact that you just kind of drift right into the voices and then the music, you've no idea what it is until you listen to it, and you don't know who the writer is or who the musicians are or the poet is until the end of the thing, and then you find out. It is a one, and I don't know of any other radio program really like it. And there is this, and I keep on harping on and saying intimate, but it is this, there's a quietness to it, there's a gentleness to it, but it's also, I think, I don't like the term slice of life, but it does give a slice of life of who we are, who we were, who we think we were, who we would like to remember ourselves as being. And I do also think the great thing about it is there are so many essays in the show from Irish people living overseas, and you get this wonderful kind of insight into the Irish diaspora as well.
We've asked both of you to choose some other pieces that are in the anthology as well. Connor obviously modestly precludes you picking your wife's your wife's piece. So you chose Eamon Omar Hertig's story about going to the All-Irelands with his father Micheál.
Oh, it's just a beautiful, beautiful story. It's really just his memories of All-Ireland Day, getting up and the father rushing in and opening the curtains and saying, let the light in. And then all the incredible enthusiasm and up in the dual carriageway and the big Chinese on the nice dual carriageway and then up to the dressing rooms. And it's just so evocative of his father, Micheál, and of just a wonderful day. Do you know those kind of days we have which are just golden? And I just loved it so much for that. The sense of joy and positivity and light in it are just magical. And he just captures it beautifully.
Let's have a listen to a piece of the original Sunday Miscellany recording. This is Eamon Omar Hertig, All-Ireland Sundays with Dad.
Sunday mornings meant only one thing for our family, the Omar Hertigs, and that was matches. Of course, there was Mass before that, usually first Mass at 8 a.m, so we could get on the road early to McHale Park, Castlebar, or Páirce Caoimh in Cork, or St Tiernan's Park in Clonus. Father Harris, a tip man, was our parish priest, and if tip hurlers were playing in the Munster hurling final, the Mass would be over in 15 minutes from start to finish. You would be heading towards Wong's Chinese Takeaway on the Nace Jewel carriageway before the altar boys had time to ring the bell for communion. But All-Ireland Final Sunday meant no travelling, which should have meant a lie-in for us at home. But no, Dad would rise even earlier on All-Ireland Final Sunday and come in jumping up and down with excitement to get us up, pulling open the curtains to let the morning in, as he would say.
Connor, you also chose Liz Nugent's Riverdance piece about being a stage manager for Riverdance in New York and then meeting her husband, Richard. Why did you choose that?
Well, I know Liz and I know her husband, Richard, and what I loved about it, as well as the fact she's sitting at home in Dublin one day and the next she's on Broadway stage managing and call in a Riverdance that has changed hugely from the Riverdance that she last did. She was a stage manager on one of the tours. But when they got to Broadway, they changed the show. So a massively stressful week.
She was bluffing and she admits
totally
that, which
bluffing.
Was nice. She can admit it 25
years on. Yeah, so you're kind of
you're
feeling it with her. And then at the end of the week, as she says, of course, naturally, what would we do at the end of a 100-hour week except just go off to the pub together? So they did. And then the next day she went, she was introduced by Bill Whelan to Richard, who'd worked on the recordings, I think, for Riverdance. And they went for a walk and started a conversation. And as she said, we're still having that conversation 25 years later.
Niall, I want to go to one of those ones that you've chosen. It's William Wall's The Sea That Defies Time.
Yes. Well, I'm a sucker for anything involving the sea. And it's curious, one of the things about this piece is, and I think it goes back to what you were saying, Sarah, about the flow, because this is a piece which is about this town in Italy. And it's a historical piece, but it's also a travel piece and it's a personal piece. And it includes mentions of language and history. And it packs so much in to a few minutes, and it's a piece that I think is both intellectual and emotional and really quite moving.
Okay, let's take a little something from that.
O sea, you defy time since the dawn of the world. The word for dawn is alba. It's derived from the Latin word albus. Album means a blank writing tablet, so each new dawn is a blank page upon which a new day can be written. And the Alba del Mondo is the first blank page of all, the dawn of time upon which a whole universe and its inhabitants and imaginings would form the text. And Camogli is just the kind of place to inspire such reflections. By and large, the sea here is gentle. A more or less constant swell runs along the shore, collapsing gently against the breakwater and the pebbly beach. The varicoloured houses and restaurants look out on it with affection. The inhabitant spends as much time as possible on the beach, often coming down from their workplaces to eat their lunch there, or play cards, or just sleep the siesta away. But when the Ligurian sea is angry, the storms are truly destructive. There are photographs of waves breaking against the bell tower of the Basilica of Santa Maria. One particularly bad storm a few years ago flooded the entire waterfront and knocked down most of the restaurants above the beach. In nearby Rapallo, it completely destroyed the harbour and drove over 100 yachts onto the rocks, including the very expensive motor yacht of none other than Silvio Berlusconi. It's an ill wind, one might say.
That's William Wall from The Sea That Defies Time. Sarah, asking you to choose your favourite pieces would be deeply unfair to you, but here we are. Are there notable ones that are in this collection that you'd like to mention?
I mean, there are so many, and I like, even at 150, there are lots of people you couldn't include. I mean, we're in this wonderful position of just having such great choice, but I'm very pleased with the pieces we have in this. Something I would say when we were talking about what is the programme, what is not the programme, I do sometimes say to contributors who might be, you know, liable to take a swipe or be a bit spiky, and that's their personal style, and I'd be like, actually, we're going to pull that back a bit. And we have a kind of joke. I say warm and fuzzy and proud. Now, or I'm exaggerating to make a point, because I think very much, you don't, you know, the world is quite divided at the moment. We do not want to contribute to that division, nor do we want to assault people with the news cycle, because they've enough coming at them already. But you can still write about, make a comment about what's going on and an appeal for, you know, togetherness. You don't even have to use the kind of the newsy words. And there's a piece by the late, very much missed Judith Mock, opera singer and a brilliant writer. She's got a memoir with Lilliput, but she did a piece for us a couple of years ago called Hanukkah, and it's about her own family history, her Jewish family and her menorah and lighting it. This is, you know, not long after things got very bad in Israel-Palestine. She talks about what's going on in the world. She has an experience on the street in Dublin with an Egyptian chef, a pizza chef, and they start to talk about Umm Kulthum, the Egyptian, the singer that they both knew. And it's an incredible piece. So that is one that I would highlight.
Let's take something from that now.
The winter cold encloses our days in Dublin, where we stay inside and read off screens or pages to learn, or even wish sometimes we could unlearn what others tell us about the world. We watch small miracles unfold around us. They light up briefly, like Hanukkah candles. Over the course of the last year, I have sat for long hours among sick human beings, some of whom share the same ailment I suffer from, who keep their heads bent, as if their newly acquired baldness is too heavy a weight for them to be able to sit up straight and look up, maybe to a future. For me, a future would mean more understanding and the ability to strike a match and cast a miraculously lasting light on the events in our lives, to line up facts into minute details, including the insufferable misunderstandings of war, racial injustice, poverty, hunger, and incurable illnesses.
And that's Judith Mock, an extract from Hanukkah. Sarah Binchy, Niall McArdle, Conor Lennon, thank you so much for joining me tonight on Arena.
Thank you.
Sunday Miscellany, A Selection 2023 to 2025, edited by Sarah Binchy, is published by New Island Books. The programme is broadcast every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. here on RTE Radio 1, and you can listen back to previous episodes at rte.ie/radio1 or on the RTE Radio app.
Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. I'll walk down the lane with a hat.
The unmistakable sound of Gene Kelly from 1952's Singing in the Rain. Gene Kelly was part of Hollywood's golden age. He was an actor, a dancer, a singer, a choreographer and a director of musicals such as Singing in the Rain, On the Town and An American in Paris. He went on to win an honorary Oscar, a Golden Globe and lifetime honors from the American Film Institute and the Kennedy Center. But Kelly, the grandson of Irish immigrants, never forgot his Irish roots, a place he called his spiritual home. He was the proud owner of an Irish passport, which he used regularly to visit here, and was unsurprisingly a lifelong student of Irish dance and culture. A new documentary by Darragh Films, Raelt an Rinca, celebrates the life of Kelly and paints an intimate portrait of the man behind the legend. It features an exclusive interview with his daughter, Kerry Kelly Novick, and previously unseen family archives. Raelt an Rinca was produced and directed by Brian Redden. He joins me now in studio. Brian, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
I suppose with a name like Kelly, it seems likely that Gene had an Irish background. What was it?
Yeah. In fact, he's even more Irish now. His full name is Eugene Curran Kelly. So yeah, he's got a great Irish background. On his mother's side, his grandfather came from Derry, and his name is William Curran. So he's got a grandfather from Derry. He's got a great grandfather on his father's side from Clare, and that's where the Kelly came from. So the Kelly guy emigrated to Canada and ended up in Pittsburgh and married a woman from there, and that's where the Irish comes from. So the Irish is on both sides of the family, really, you know. And he grows up in Pittsburgh. He's born in Pittsburgh in 1912, and Pittsburgh was quite an Irish town. A lot of Irish had gone there after the famine, but weren't welcomed initially in Pittsburgh, as in a lot of places in America. Like, people think, you know, the Irish are always welcome with open arms. We weren't really. Certainly on that coast, you know, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, you know, the Irish came over, the Irish were poor, quite often didn't speak English, were seen as drunk and reckless and fighters and all the rest of it. So Kelly grows up in an Irish neighborhood in Pittsburgh, in what is really probably the machoest town in America. Pittsburgh is a place where there's steel mills there. You know, all the work there is very manly work, you know. So to be a young Irish boy interested in dancing in a town like that, you know, he had it very tough.
Let's have a listen to this. This is from your documentary. This is Virginia Montanez. She's a local journalist. And then Kelly's daughter, Kerry Kelly Novick, is in this clip as well, talking about what it was like for Irish immigrants in Pittsburgh when Gene was a boy.
So his family, first of all, has a very Irish name. It's the Kellys. And there are people that are ridiculed and stereotyped and being held out of certain jobs. So this is why we call the Kelly family Lace Curtain Irish, because his mother was seeking a, she was putting advertisements in the newspaper when Jean was four looking for a nanny. So they were well established to be able to afford a nanny at this point when Jean was four. But just having the money doesn't erase the prejudice. He still was going to experience it.
So he grew up in a social context of enormous discrimination and prejudice. He used to tell long stories about how to get from their house to their primary school. They had to traverse a Polish neighborhood and a Jewish neighborhood and an Italian neighborhood. These were all population groups that were not friendly to each other because they were all competing as immigrants for whatever labor was available. So the way he described it, he fought his way to school every day and back.
He was a fan of Irish dancing, and he was a fan of tap dancing as well. You have a great moment in the documentary, and it's archive footage of him on what I presume is American television, talking about how Irish dancing is done with the arms by the side, and the very traditional Irish dancing, and then trying to explain how that becomes part of tap dancing and part of dances taken from Africa into the southern United States as well. It's a really great piece.
Yeah, well, you heard his daughter talking there, and she tells us that, you know, when he started off in Pittsburgh, he learned Irish dance. So he learned Irish dance. He was part, his whole family were dancers, and he was part of a kind of a vaudeville group called the Five Little Kellys. So he's the middle of five kids. So he grew up learning how to Irish dance as well as other types of dance, and he was always fascinated by Irish dancing. So in the 1950s, he made this TV, it was a documentary called Dancing is a Man's Game, because he was always very much about that. He was always very much about how it was, you know, that real men danced. It was a macho thing. And in that documentary, he dances with a lot of sportsmen at the time to show that you had to have the body of a sportsman to dance, which is true. In it, he draws these parallels between Irish dancing and how Irish dancing basically influenced and eventually morphed into tap dancing. And he illustrates very clearly how Irish jigs and reels and all that kind of the Irish dancing mixed in with what he calls slow step dancing that was brought over from Africa, I suppose. And those two things merged together to create modern day tap. And that's pretty much, you know, recognised today. But he was one of the first people to talk about that. And what was interesting about him is, at a time in the 1940s and 50s and 60s, when he was doing Irish dance on screen, and he does it quite a lot, like in the movies, he often breaks into Irish dancing, more so when he was doing TV shows. When he was on like the Dean Martin show or the Julie Andrews show, he'd always do a kind of an Irish shtick where he'd do a little jig. But in lots of movies, he did it too. But he was doing it at a time when people over here, where Irish dancing wasn't as popular in Ireland at the time. I mean, this is way before Riverdance, but it was cool, you know? So people in Ireland, to be able to see a son of Ireland on screen doing Irish dancing and being proud to do it meant an awful lot to people over here going to the cinema and watching that. It gave them a great sense of pride, you know, in their national dance, to see it on the world stage by a son of the diaspora. So it was really important what he did for Irish dance.
He became huge on the big screen, having had moments on Broadway to begin with. That's where his initial fame comes. But once he arrives in Hollywood, things start to happen for him, don't they?
Yeah. So he leaves Pittsburgh in 1940. So he's 28 years of age when he goes to Broadway and starts having a career in Broadway, which is quite old for a dancer. So Pal Joey, people would know the movie Pal Joey. Frank Sinatra was in the film version. He made his name on Broadway in Pal Joey, became a huge hit in that Rodgers and Hart musical. And what happened then is quite often what happened in those days was Hollywood came calling. If you were a star on Broadway, you were brought to Hollywood, you were given a screen test and you were made a star. It was that easy back then. And in 1942, at the age of 30, he makes his first movie, and that's For Me and My Gal with Judy Garland. Of course, Judy Garland was the height of her fame then, and this whippersnapper from Broadway comes over and all of a sudden has a co-lead with her, and he's magnificent in that film. So immediately, You know, he's right up there. He becomes a star very, very quickly. But then the war kind of interrupts his career. And quite interestingly, he was quite a patriotic man. And he always put that down to his Irish background, his strict Irish Catholic background. He had a very strong sense of right and wrong, a very strong kind of moral streak went through him. And he enlisted. So even though he was a movie star, obviously didn't have to enlist. Others kind of avoided it, but he went straight into the army and ended up making documentaries, actually in the documentary kind of propaganda unit.
This is great. It's also from your documentary. It's Aideen Gormley talking first to begin with from RTÉ Lyric FM, and then Kelly himself talking about what happened when World War II broke out.
Dárach agus dándaigh an buinte seo tréis briseadh amach agus bhí ar listóilí anamh ach ní raibh ar aon tríd anamh. Bhí sé denamh scannán bolscoireachta agus scannán faisnéise.
I didn't even know I was nominated for the Academy Award for Anchors Away because I was in the Navy. And a very nice captain came down from a ship and he said, congratulations to you. Well, I just heard, you know, that you were nominated for the Academy Award.
I mean, Hollywood was awash with those great dancers back in the 40s and 50s. What was it about him, about his dancing, about his on-screen presence, about his choreography that made him stand out?
Yeah, he was very, very, very different. But just before I tell you that, you see the clip he just played there? Mm. That's from RTÉ, actually. He's been interviewed there in 1973 by Donegal O'Dooling in Kennedy's pub in Puckon in Tipperary. That's where that interview took place. So what made him different really was that, okay, up until that point, you know, dancing on screen in Hollywood movies was very much the Fred Astaire style of dancing. It was very much, you know, top hat and tails, very much in the ballroom, very much, you know, shot on stages, big Busby Berkeley kind of musicals or Esther Williams jumping into a swimming pool, those kind of things. What he brought to it was, he brought a kind of a working man sensibilities to dancing. You know, he always wore, he never wore tails. He never wore top hats. He always wore his shirt sleeves rolled up and he always wore like a tank top. And, you know, he was kind of like, he was like a guy who would be, might be dancing on the side of the street on a building site, you know, a working man, you know. So he had a very macho style of dancing, a very kind of aggressive way of dancing. It wasn't the kind of debonair, slick ballroom style that people had become used to. It was street dancing, you know, and it was tough and it was rough. And it gave people the sense that, you know, I could do that. I could dance like that. So his style of dancing was very, very particular. And then also what he did was he kind of revolutionised the way dance was seen on screen. Because, as I said, up until that point, a lot of the movies took place on sets. So he brought it outdoors and he started dancing on locations. Like famously, the movie he first directed or co-directed was called On the Town. And in that, he shot on location in New York City. First time a musical had been brought out of the studios on location. So when he's dancing down the street in New York, that's an actual street. Cars going by, people going by, real people, real passers-by. No idea they were featuring in a Hollywood musical. So he really revolutionised how dance was seen on screen, as well as also shooting himself in, you know, full body from head to toe. You know, so what Fred Astaire used to insist on was people would cut to close-ups of his feet so you could see his feet move. Gene said, no, show my whole body. I'm dancing with my arms, my hips, my legs, my face, everything. So don't just cut to the feet. I want people to see the whole thing. So how it was on screen was revolutionised by him as well.
And a lot of the time, those lack of cuts meant that everything you saw in front of you was happening in real time.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's amazing. Like, for example, there's a film he made called It's Always Fair Weather, which he co-directed. And in that, there's a whole sequence, which is one shot, right? One shot, it's on a dolly, it tracks with him the whole way along for about 2 minutes, and he's dancing on roller skates. Like actual roller skates. And he doesn't fall. Like, it's unbelievable. You look at him going, how is he staying up on those things? So you're absolutely right. There was no room for error in there. And he was a perfectionist. So every single thing he did, you know, he worked on, he rehearsed. In the documentary, we've a piece in the documentary with his daughter talking about a scene where he dances on a newspaper in Summerstock. It was a famous movie he made with Phil Silvers, who later became famous as Sergeant Bilko and with Judy Garland. And he kind of tap dances on a sheet of newspaper. It seems really simple, right? Tap dancing on the paper, ripping the paper up with his feet, tearing the paper with his hands, getting a certain sound out of the paper. But his daughter tells us that nearly 2 weeks rehearsing with that, buying, you know, reams and reams of newspaper to find just the right one that made the right sound and ripped the right way. So real perfectionist he was, you know.
It's been great to talk to you, Brian Redden. Thanks so much for coming
Thanks so much.
Chatting to us. Producer and director of the new Gene Kelly documentary, Rails on Rinka. It's going to be broadcast on TG Cahir on Christmas Day. And you're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. You might be writing your Christmas cards at the moment, or maybe if your friends and family still send them, receiving them through the post this week. Robins, reindeer and Santa and a sack are still favourites, but some still reach for images of baby Jesus and the Nativity, images often inspired by Nativity art created by Caravaggio, Botticelli or Leonardo da Vinci. Joining me now to dig into that history of the birth of Jesus on canvas is art historian Jess Fahey. Jess, let's go back to the very beginning. How long has the Nativity scene itself been a factor in Western art?
So we actually believe that there are some that exist in the catacombs in Rome, but potentially even before the Edict of Milan, which would have been when Constantine finally sort of allowed for Christianity. And in those instances, they'd be very sort of basic scenes. So you might just see a swaddled child with a female character, presumably Mary, or in some carving versions, you will actually have the swaddled child with just the ox and the donkey, which again is kind of interesting to consider that they would be considered more important than Mary or Joseph. So then from that time period, as Christianity becomes the main religion, we're talking, of course, in the Western world, in Europe in particular, in this instance, the scene becomes more developed and more popular.
Was there a generally agreed idea of the events of the Nativity in terms of these works of art? And was that drawn from the Bible at all?
Yeah, see, this is one of the things I always find so fascinating, because there's both a written and a visual tradition, and they seem to go back and forth between being influential on each other. So in the Gospels, the four Gospels that were chosen for the New Testament, it's only in Luke and Matthew that there's any mention of the birth of Christ, and they don't actually tell the story exactly the same. And I think because so many of us grew up being either in a nativity or have gone to see them, we assume that the story is written in this very concise and very, not actually concise, but more sort of detailed and chronological order. Whereas in actual fact, in the Gospels, you really just have one account that says about the manger and no room at the inn, which is the same version. This is from Luke that mentions the shepherds. And then in Matthew's, it doesn't mention the manger or the shepherds. Instead, it mentions the three magi coming with their gifts. In fact, it doesn't even say there's three. It just says these wise men come. They later become kings in the visual description of them. And now we usually think about them as the three kings, but that was just a visual language to show that they were important. And actually in some of the earlier depictions, they're shown as more closely to what we might recognizes symbolically as priests. So this is something fascinating about how this thing can change over time.
So is there an element of, or a possibility that some of the works of art we're about to talk about may be that which influences what we now see as the traditional nativity that's, you know, performed in school plays at Christmas?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is another influence, though, to take into account that we often forget because they're more ephemeral, and that is the actual live action mystery plays from the medieval period, and even, in fact, live action nativity scenes where they would have people act out the various characters. So the performance element, a sort of staging, if you like, would have had an impact on the visual arts as well.
Okay, some of the paintings that we're about to talk about are up on the RTE Arena Instagram account. You'll find us at RTE_Arena. So tell me about Giotto and his nativity in 1305. He changed the face of painting, but did he bring in a kind of naturalism here that hadn't been done before?
Yes. So if anyone has ever been lucky enough to go to the Scrivini Chapel in Padua, which is this incredible fresco-filled jewel box, essentially, of early Renaissance art, all by Giotto, all commissioned by Enrico Scrivini because he was a moneylender. So he wanted to prove that he was a good person by using the money that he had made to commission the building of this church and the painting of it. So as is typical with, you know, looking for a nativity scene, it often will feature in the life story of Christ. So this is where it exists within the Scrivini Chapel. So it's very important to sort of think about this almost like a kind of comic book. You know, you're going from scene to scene to scene. So in this instance, he has tried very hard, as we know is typical with Giotto, to give a sense of volume to the figures and to give a sense of three dimensions to the setting that they exist within. It's not perfect, and there's lots of scale issues. The Virgin and Child, for example, seem much larger than everyone else, although we could also see this as symbolically accurate in the sense that they're considered more important. We also see Joseph in this instance looking like he's asleep in the foreground, and this might actually come from medieval plays where he was often kind of almost like a sort of foolish character, almost like a clown sort of figure. But in terms of the naturalism that you mentioned, one of the things that we see him attempting is to show the setting, which he has chosen to be this manger setting with both the ox and the donkey and a little lean-to kind of shed over the main figures.
I'm interested, as we move forward to kind of early Renaissance, it's about 150 years on, the paintings by Botticelli and by Leonardo da Vinci. Tell us about those.
Well, this is another thing that's fascinating too, is that you can end up finding out a little bit more about the culture where the particular version was depicted. So in the case of Florence in the 15th century, particularly after the birth of Lorenzo il Magnifico de Medici, so the famous Lorenzo the Magnificent, his family seemed to have become particularly associated with, in particular, the arriving of the three kings, the Magi. So artists more increasingly paint this scene, including Botticelli and Leonardo, and it seems it's because that the family are so associated with it, to be in with the Medici, who are essentially the de facto rulers of the supposedly Republic Florence at the time, you commission that scene. So in one instance by Botticelli, which is a particularly good version, it's in the Uffizi in Florence, and it's the Adoration of the Magi, but included in it is believed to be a portrait of the man who commissioned it, Zanobi di Lamma, and a portrait of Lorenzo the Magnificent, but also fascinatingly a portrait of Botticelli looking out towards us. And we start to, in this time period, see it more increase that we have an artist included within the work, and usually they're the one who are looking out. In this instance too, he's going for much greater naturalism, as would be expected in this, you know, point of the Renaissance, including great detail of ruined and classical buildings in the background, which is a symbol of the old world dying out and the new world coming in with the advent of the birth of Christ, which we also see then in Leonardo's version of the Adoration of the Magi, although, as many people know about him, he never really finished many paintings, and this is one of the most famous examples of being unfinished by him, commissioned by the Augustinian monks of San Donato a Scopeta in Florence, probably again to gain some influence with the Medici. But Leonardo leaves it unfinished in 1482 when he goes to Milan, but there are some drawings that exist as he worked out this composition that make it, you know, one of the most interesting, complex, and, you know, really quite detailed examples of any version of a nativity scene, which of course is no surprise coming from Leonardo.
I have to skip forward here, but in more recent years, how have painters, I use the term recent loosely, how have painters of the 18th and 19th century depicted the nativity?
So, without going too much detail, the 17th century, it's important to note that after the Renaissance, where there's a more highly kind of idealized or stylized style that we sometimes call mannerism or a continuation of the High Renaissance, everything becomes much more naturalistic with people like Caravaggio and such. But as we get into the 18th and 19th century, there's actually almost a return to some of the mysticism that you would see in earlier versions, particularly in relation to Botticelli. So you have people like the Pre-Raphaelites, who in fact John Ruskin would have known a work by Botticelli known as the Mystic Nativity, which has a weird sort of combination of Savonarola, you know, the end of world preacher from the 15th century, of his ideas that the nativity should sort of reflect the end of times as well. A very unusual work. It's in the National Gallery. So Ruskin actually identified that work. And then, of course, Ruskin being influenced on the Pre-Raphaelites. So So they get more interested in, again, a kind of magic quality to it rather than a sort of naturalism, gritty, here's the reality of the, you know, dirty manger or the, you know, difficulty of the situation. And then as we go into the modern period, you have people like Gauguin who take it up, mixing it in with Tahitian culture when he's living there. Or more recently, there's a Banksy, an actual little, almost like a model of a nativity, but it's in the hotel that he created over in Gaza. And instead of the star leading the figures, there's a hole in the wall, clearly caused by some sort of weapon or missile or something like that. So a very clever sort of play on the, you know, original location of the birth. And also the violence that's happening there and the time that he made it long before the war, but still making that comment.
What are the best places to see the Nativity in Ireland as far as you're concerned?
I suppose there are some examples in the National Gallery, but I actually think the most perhaps authentic way of experiencing it is going to the various different churches or places that have cribs, either inside or outside. I certainly know that when we were children, we made our own, but it was made of a combination of Star Wars figures and Sylvanian families, which probably isn't the most orthodox version. But there is something, I think, kind of magical about that sort of community element of people going to see these things together, even going to see the Nativity play, as well as then, you know, the more traditional art history as we've been talking about.
Is it fair to say that the Nativity has possibly fallen out of favour in recent decades and in recent, well, in the last 100 years?
I suppose that's true of all kind of religious imagery. Certainly in terms of art history, it's nowhere near as popular. And I suppose in thinking about, as you said at the very beginning, the different type of Christmas images, and most of them actually come from the Victorian period, all of the other kind of, you know, Santa Claus or the Robin. And there's a, I suppose, a mixture too between some of those pagan traditions that would have existed before the Christian ones. So you could see the Christian ones as usurping them too. And maybe now we're in a, you know, again, a more pluralized society. So I suppose it makes sense that it wouldn't be as common a new subject, if you like, for artists to explore.
I hate asking people to pick one thing, but out of everything that we've discussed tonight, and maybe some of those that we didn't, is there a single depiction of the Nativity that if people were to be somewhere in Europe, for instance, that they should make an effort to go see?
Yeah, I think like that, as I was saying about, you know, sort of in Florence, there's many very good examples, but there's a northern tradition too. So any of the, you know, museums in the Netherlands, from the Rijksmuseum to even museums in Germany and Berlin, you can go and see the northern version. Northern Renaissance in particular was interested in more narrative detail, often having more than one of the stories being told all at once within them. And one of the famous artists in relation to this is Hugo van der Goes, or Robert Campin, who used to copy his depictions, his style. And in particular, what I like is that there's two extra figures often in these depictions, which are the two midwives. So the practicality of thinking about, well, who was with the Virgin when she was giving birth? How did this happen? And as a consequence of that, you know, this sort of extra story comes in. And one of the figures in it is Salome, now not the Salome of John the Baptist, a different Salome. And apparently, according to the story, and this again is, you know, not within the Gospels, but according to the story, she believes that it's a lie that a virgin couldn't give birth, and that as a consequence, God withers her hands until the angels come and tell her that if she just touches the Christ child, her hands will come back to life again.
Jess, so it's Fahey, these extra stories. We're going to have to stop it there. We've run out of time, unfortunately. But thank you so much for joining us tonight to talk about Nativity art here on Arena. That's it for us tonight. Rage Luby produced, Paula Shields was our researcher, Ollie Hamilton the broadcast coordinator, and Paul Murnock was on sound supervision. Apologies for the slight lateness to news. John Creedon is next, and I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7.